But I built a platform just to prove the idea that we could identify talented students from low-income backgrounds and get them into Oxford and Cambridge University. That's not a normal thing to do at all. But that £100,000 investment back in 2019 was just the start of an investment journey where we've now raised £6.5 million since I started the organisation. Young people spend more hours every week nowadays on their phones than they do in the classroom, which on the one hand is quite scary, but on the other hand is a massive opportunity. You have to be a little bit crazy. A lot of these students don't even realise they have what it takes to break into a top institution, so that we'd created something really special there. You've got to prove that you can actually, you know, deliver on your promise and vision.
So Joe, that was a amazing, really great conversation, wasn't it?
He was so inspiring, what he'd done setting it up by himself with £200 from his student debt and turning into what it's become today is an incredible story.
Yeah, I think we go through everything there from how their platform works, which is amazing for students, but also how he, as you say, started from nothing following his degree to building
an amazing platform that helps so many students.
He was
really cool.
I think our audience are going to love it. So we will let you tune in now and hear about Joe's journey.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm taking you behind the future.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Future. We have the fabulous Nina back with us today. Nina, tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm a year 13 student and I'm studying media, business and psychology A-level and hopefully pursuing marketing at university next year.
Amazing. Well, this is going to be super helpful.
Definitely.
That's what we're hoping anyway.
Yes.
So Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm Joe Seddon. I'm the founder and CEO of Zero Gravity. We're a tech platform that powers students from low opportunity areas of the country into top universities and careers. So I'm really interested in that question of how do you break that link between background and opportunity? Because I believe there's so much talent in this country, which is currently going unrecognized and untapped. And I want to do something to change that.
I love that. That was so succinct as well. Like, I get it. And I'm really looking forward to unpacking that. So let's start with Nina. What's your first question?
So your company, Zero Gravity, maybe explain a bit about what you guys do and what your role in the company is.
Sure. So I founded Zero Gravity straight out of university to solve a problem that I'd very much seen in my own life. So I grew up in a small town in the north of the UK called Morley, which is sort of between Leeds and Wakefield, if you've ever heard of those places before. It's a sort of suburban post-industrial market town. And my mum is a speech therapist in the NHS. I come from a single parent background. I just sort of saw firsthand how difficult it is to be a student living in a small town in the UK with big ambitions, but not necessarily the resources, the network, the know-how to sort of make it into these leading universities and careers. And I was one of the lucky ones. I managed to win a place at Oxford University, which was a life-changing moment for someone like me. No one in my family had been to Oxbridge before, but I was very much an outlier in doing so. In the year I graduated from university, not a single person from the parliamentary constituency I grew up in won a place at Oxford. And there's sort of 100,000 people who live in these areas. Wow. So I was very much an outlier and I wanted to do something to essentially help the future generations of people like me, the people who have the ambition, have the talent, but not necessarily the inside track. What can we do to make sure those people can fully realize their potential? And that's why I started Zero Gravity when I finished university.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. A big step as well. So straight out of uni, back to home and started it from home.
Yeah, and that was a big kind of social choice I had to make, because when I graduated from Oxford, most of my friends moved straight into London into these very sort of corporate, prestigious graduate jobs. And indeed, I had one of those lined up as well. I was going to become a lawyer, but I decided to turn that down because I was so passionate about this idea. But because I didn't have any money in my bank account, I couldn't move that back to London. I couldn't even afford to stay in Oxford where I'd been to university. So I moved back in with my mum and sister back home. And that was a really tricky period because this was before Zero Gravity kind of even existed, let alone had built kind of traction or any of the trappings of success. So my friends, my family thought I'd gone completely bonkers, to be honest. They were like, why are you messing around with all this entrepreneurship stuff? To be a sort of startup founder in West Yorkshire, that's not a normal thing to do at all. I think when I was telling people about it in the pub and stuff, they thought it was just like an innuendo for unemployment, and I was sort of delaying my step into reality. So there's some real kind of social barriers to battle against. I think in the UK, we don't have that kind of American style hustle founder culture. And that means that the psychological barriers in many cases can be just as big as the material ones, which a lot of early stage founders face.
Yeah. And how did you get started then?
I leveraged the power of the internet. So I'm a kind of Gen Z. I'm right on that cusp between Gen Z and millennials. And I'd grown up my entire life with all these incredible new tech products coming out. They're from the iPhone when I was starting secondary school to all these social media platforms, Uber, Deliveroo, and all these platforms which transformed every facet of my life. So I was a digital native. So I just started with what I knew, which is I went back to West Yorkshire. I was in my room and I pulled out my laptop and I thought, what can I do literally from my bedroom to actually have an impact countrywide? So what I did is I built a very basic platform, and it wasn't very good at first, to be honest. It was a real sort of cobbled together, very basic piece of technology. But I built a platform just to prove the idea that we could identify talented students from low-income backgrounds and get them into Oxford and Cambridge University. I didn't try and change the world overnight. I didn't focus on all the universities or all the careers. I just focused on two particular universities, just to almost like trial the idea and show that it could work. And thankfully, it took off. We managed to sign up hundreds of students in our first cohort and thousands of mentors. And a number of them got into Oxford and Cambridge University. Indeed, in the first year, 50 students managed to win a place. Yeah. And what was more impactful than the data was just the incredible stories. And these were people who'd grown up on really tricky council estates, often from the single parent families. No one in their school had been to universities like this before, and they were sort of one of a kind. And when they kind of articulated their journey, often they'd use phrases completely unprompted about how zero gravity put them on a different track. And that led me to believe, even though our user numbers were small, that we'd created something really special here, which with a bit more resource and a bit more time, I could scale into something much bigger.
Wow. That's amazing. So you said that you are originally from a small town. What motivated you to go to Oxford and pursue this career path?
Well, even the idea of going to university wasn't necessarily given for someone like me. And over my lifetime, university has become a more normal thing for people of my age in a place like Morley. But going to those kind of really prestigious selective universities, that was something that very, very few people did. So it wasn't necessarily on my radar, but I got a really good set of GCSEs at my state secondary school that I went to. And I was one of those kids who was sort of put up to speak on live radio. And then when they sort of tell you on results day, you're going on BBC Radio Leeds. And obviously as a 16-year-old, that's a very nerve-wracking thing to do. And the interviewer asked me live on radio, he said, "Joe, this is a great set of results. Are you going to think about giving Oxbridge a go? And how do you think you'll fare in that process as a kind of state-educated lad from Yorkshire?" I remember just freezing live on radio because that question had never even crossed my mind before. But that kind of arbitrary moment planted the seed where I thought afterwards, oh, maybe I should actually think about giving this a go. So it was completely random, but that planted the seed of an ambition. But because no one in my family had done it before, I didn't really know how to get started. So again, I did what I knew best, which is I got out my laptop. I sort of plugged into YouTube how to get into Oxbridge and literally use the internet to get a bit of a better sense of what it would take someone like me to succeed. And it wasn't perfect. Just by watching YouTube videos, you can't change your stars overnight. But it did give me a little bit of a better idea than if I existed, 30 years ago, when literally there would have been no way to tap into that universe, whatsoever.
Amazing. And so what did you study at university?
So I did philosophy, politics and economics. It's sometimes shortened to PPE, but it's quite confusing now because after COVID, everyone thinks PPE is the sort of like hazmat protection suits. But it's a degree which is kind of renowned and infamous now, to be honest, for educating a lot of politicians. So, sort of David Cameron's, Ed Miliband's.
Yeah.
A lot of politicians of that generation did this degree because it was originally created to essentially like educate the elites of the future. Back in the days when Britain had an empire, people would study this degree and then be sent to sort of govern all these different places across the globe. So it's kind of got a quite controversial route in that sense, but it was perfect for me because I was someone who was just really interested in how the world worked. I didn't want to pin myself down to one particular subject. So I thought if I can master these three really core subjects, I can get a better sense of actually how can I make the system work for me, rather than that sense I had when I was growing up, which is I was someone who was having change happen to me,
yeah,
rather than it being something I could control or influence myself.
But nothing in there was how to then go and create a platform and build it. So how do you, when you've returned to Yorkshire and you're about to start this business, suddenly learn to code a platform? Did you do that yourself? Did you get support? How did that happen?
So I had sort of intermediate level tech skills that I'd self-taught growing up. But because I was right on the kind of edge of that Gen Z generation, I missed all of these great platforms out there nowadays where you can kind of learn to code with AI. So for me, it was literally like HTML for dummies style textbook was how I learned, and then trial by error. So I had basic skills, but I certainly was not a kind of genius computer programmer. And the key myth I had to dispel was this kind of cultural meme that you can be an overnight success. If you watch any movie about being an entrepreneur, whether it's, you know, The Wolf of Wall Street or The Social Network, they always paint the startup journey as kind of like very glamorous, you know, kind of rock and roll style journey where it all happens, you know, very suddenly. But the reality is, for pretty much every single business, it takes years to get this right. And the way to sort of get going and build that traction is to actually focus on the most narrow problem you can, to actually test and pilot your idea. So as I mentioned, that's what I did. And I didn't try and, you know, build this platform to completely transform the UK. I just focused on one very narrow slice of the problem, which is how do you get low-income students into Oxford and Cambridge? And I built that very basic platform just to do that. And when it came to the marketing, that was even more basic at the beginning. My first ever piece of social media content about Zero Gravity was a really crappy animated video that I posted on my own Facebook wall. And that tells you kind of like how basic this was. Obviously, no one uses Facebook nowadays to interact with their friends. But this was back in 2018, where for me, you know, coming out of university, Facebook was still the kind of predominant social network. And I thought, I've got an audience on my account of 1,000 friends. They all know 1,000 people. Even though this is a very unsophisticated way to start, when it comes to getting some initial distribution, this is probably the way to go. And that's what I did.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And how, so going, because I suppose you've got the whole, you've got what you can do, but also you need Oxford and Cambridge, and then after that, other universities to want to listen and to want to welcome students from different areas. How was that pushing on an open door? Was it just that they weren't seeing these students represented in applications and they wanted to be? Or was there an uphill battle to show them that this was the right way to go?
It definitely wasn't pushing on an open door. That there was a kind of zeitgeist in the country that universities in particular weren't working for people from low opportunity areas. There'd been a lot of political discussion about universities being too posh, too exclusive. Companies were also starting to change their recruitment policies away from the kind of typical conveyor belt from Oxbridge into the city. So there was a kind of like fervent environment I was stepping into. But in terms of actually getting companies and universities on board, it's almost an impossible thing to do when you're starting a very, very early stage company, especially as a 21-year-old founder at the time who kind of looked perceptibly like not a typical startup founder. No, I didn't have the kind of years of experience. I'd never built a business before. I looked young as well. So for any company or university, seeing that just screams, no, risk, risk, risk. So I knew I couldn't get these people on board straight away. So my kind of strategy was, how do I essentially disintermediate the institutions? How do I go around them and find a way to build this fantastic B2C platform first to test my concept before I then have the kind of evidence and the kind of execution to then be able to go to these institutions and get them to partner. Mm-hmm. So and nowadays we've got over 30 major companies who are commercially partnered with Zero Gravity. You know, the big names that you see on the high street, your Lloyds Bank, HSBC, KPMG, McKinsey, Civil Service, all these massive names. But it took years to get to the point where these people wanted to meet me, because you've got to prove that you can actually deliver on your promise and vision first. And that's what I focused on in the early days.
That's amazing. So you've had to overcome a lot of barriers and like prove yourself to get the universities to listen to you. What piece of advice would you give to young people that are trying to also break down barriers to get to maybe where you are or a more prestigious university?
I think the thing that's really easy to say when you're 28 years old like me, but is really tricky when you're 17 and 18, is about trying to own your story as your kind of competitive advantage rather than the thing that holds you back. So I can talk very comfortably now about coming from a single parent background and from Yorkshire and how that built me into who I am today, the kind of resilience, that northern kind of directness, the sort of hard work, overcoming adversity. But when I was 17, 18 year old, I was petrified of talking about my background. I didn't want to acknowledge the kind of adversity I'd had to overcome. But in many ways, kind of being able to talk about that, whether it's on a personal statement or in a job interview, makes you an incredibly interesting person, because human beings, I think, have an intrinsic kind of love for an underdog. Like, no one wants to see the kind of perfectly polished, no conveyor belt, vanilla person that they've seen 200 times before. So if you're someone who has had to overcome adversity, if you can own that, instantly you stand out as someone who not only has incredible resilience, but someone who's actually performed incredibly well, given the background that they started off with. And that is what every single university and every single employer is looking for, because they're not trying to get the finished article. They're trying to invest in potential. And the best indicator of potential is how well have you performed versus the resources you had. So own your background, own your identity, turn it into your competitive advantage. And even though that can feel really tricky when you're 17 and 18, and maybe you've been trying to cover these things up because it's not easy to talk about, I would say you can flip that on its head and it can become an advantage for you.
That's such good advice. That really is. Yeah. Really good advice. And so what does the company look like today? Like, how do you reach the young people that you reach, and how do you help them?
So we've got two ways that we acquire students, to use the lingo. And that is through organic social media. So, you know, young people spend more hours every week nowadays on their phones than they do in the classroom, which on the one hand is quite scary, but on the other hand is a massive opportunity. And obviously consumer brands know about that. They market to young people every day. But a lot of education brands are almost averse to using social media. So, you know, we use essentially TikTok, Instagram, and also LinkedIn to acquire users who are actively thinking about, you know, how do I apply to university? Yeah. How do I get into a career? And that's not just about posting on our own page. The main thing that we've actually done right is user-generated content. So we get more impressions every month from our users posting about Zero Gravity than we do on our own social media accounts. Cool. And that is something that a lot of people starting off building a brand completely underestimate, which is if you get your product and brand positioning correct, you can almost create this kind of stealthy army going out there marketing your product completely for free. And that's much easier to do than trying to go viral on your own social media accounts, because the thing is, people don't tend to resonate with abstract entities like brands, but they do resonate with individual people and stories. So around half of our users come via social media. The other half come through schools. No, schools across this country are sat on a treasure trove of information about the students that they don't use in the right way. Now, every single school has, I think, 10 to 100 kind of unrecognized, almost like diamonds in the rough, who teachers might not even think that this person can go into a top university and career. But if you looked at what they've achieved at school versus their background, that person is actually a consistent overperformer. So what we've done is we built a basic piece of technology that connects into the information management systems which schools use to store their student data. And we can essentially identify the students in the school who are from the bottom 40% of socioeconomic backgrounds, but have shown those signs of overperformance. So around 50% of all our users now come through that system. We've got 900 state schools in the UK, give or take, are integrated into that system, which is around a third of all the state schools in the UK.
It is amazing.
Definitely. That is incredible. What a journey you've been on in such a short amount of time as well. What, 7 years is it then?
Seven long years.
I'm calling it short because that's it feels it. But do you know what I always think, having run my own business, you get to a point where you look back and you go, oh, that feels like the longest time, but also the shortest time, depending on which lens you put on it. So that's incredible.
Just a quick note from me. We'd love you to hit the subscribe button. This helps us more than you might realize when it comes to growing this podcast, ensuring we can bring you the best guests possible. Thank you. Back to the episode.
So that helps, though, if a student is stand out from how they're performing at school. But I suppose I've got one of our previous episodes in my head that we've done. Actually, maybe it wasn't you, but it was one that we filmed today, mm-hmm. though, of a lady that came from a really low socioeconomic background, really tough upbringing. But actually, she didn't perform at school at all. She didn't get any grades, but actually has gone on to do amazing things. But on paper, she didn't. She just wasn't turning up. So is there any way of helping spot those people where actually they're in such a bad position, they're not really engaging in school? Or would you, I suppose your content through social media might find them.
Yes, a lot of these students don't even realise they have what it takes to break into a top institution. So if you come from a small town and you go to underperforming state school, like why would you work hard at the end of the day if you don't think these opportunities are actually open and accessible to you? So a lot of the stuff that we focus on is how do you actually make this seem within reach? We're not pretending it's easy, it is hard, but how do you make it seem possible for someone like you? And the easiest way to do that is not with stats and data, it's by leveraging individual stories, people seeing people like them speaking mm-hmm. the same accents, dressed in the same way, who've grown up on the same streets, who've actually made it, you know, against the odds. But we're not a platform for everyone. At the end of the day, Zero Gravity is not a kind of magic pill that you can take and then suddenly your kind of world changes overnight. It does require, you know, dedication, perseverance, and hard work. And the routes that traditionally we are taking people on do require at least some degree of strong academic attainment. So you don't have to be perfect at school. Now, we've got lots of students who, you know, in many ways bombed their GCSEs. They were hardworking, but due to things that happened in their life, they didn't necessarily perform to their best. But in order to access these universities and careers, usually grades, unfortunately, still are a kind of stepping stone to get there. So we work with students from the age of 16. Of how do we make sure in your A-levels or your applied generals, you can do as well as possible, because in the way the system's currently structured, that often is the gateway to opportunity.
Yeah. So in Zero Gravity, what do you provide to students to help them break down the barriers and get into Oxbridge?
So in terms of how it works, it's a mobile app, and that's really important because a lot of educational software is built for desktop computers, which young people know don't use at all in their lives, maybe in a kind of IT session at school. But at home, the vast majority of young people, screen time is based on their mobile phones. And despite the fact that there's a lot of digital inequality in the UK, mobile phone access is surprisingly equal. So 99% of 16-year-olds in the UK own a smartphone, which is pretty crazy when you think about it. Out of all the resources in our society, that is the one that almost every single person has, no matter what background they're from. So it's a mobile app students can access through the phone. And there's kind of four key pillars to it. One is mentorship. So we connect students with a mentor who's one step ahead of them on the journey. So if you want to study PPE at Oxford, for instance, you'll be connected with an undergraduate currently studying that degree at Oxford University who will mentor you through our platform. Yeah. It's a mixture of video calls and messages. We also deliver masterclass content. So that is live and on-demand content delivered by the companies and universities we work with directly to students. And that's really important because a lot of these companies and universities are used to kind of doing things like open days, you know, the old traditional milk round, school assemblies. It's really disengaging content that only reaches a very shallow pool of people. So we work with them to not only distribute content digitally through our platform, but actually to style it in a way that engages a Gen Z and Gen Alpha audience. So not just kind of boring PowerPoint slides and kind of corporate jargon. Yeah. Actually styling content in a way that engages young people.
Yeah.
The third element is community. And this is often overlooked in products, but actually in my opinion is one of the most important things, which is we bring all these students together on the platform in a community where they're interacting with each other on a daily basis. And the reason that's so important is a lot of these kids are in schools or in towns where they feel like an alien, like they're the only one who has an ambition, the only one who's kind of striving to defy the odds. And that can lead to a huge sense of imposter syndrome, but also kind of narrow your view of what the possible is. So bringing these people together, you know, connecting that student in the Northeast, that kid who grows up in Cornwall, who they live in completely different parts of the country, but have that same ambition to study you know, natural sciences at Imperial, is a way to create that kind of tailwind of feeling part of an ambitious community. I mean, the final pillar is exclusive opportunities. So we work with the employers, universities we work with to create these exclusive opportunities for students. So whether it's exclusive insight days, internships. Sometimes they put a certain number of their graduate job places or apprenticeships available to our members. We try and create that kind of inside track. So people who sign up to Zero Gravity know they're almost getting like a competitive advantage. The sort of advantage that if you go to a private school, you've got on spades every single day of your life. We're creating that for people who didn't have the kind of support from day one. And that has been something that not only works great for the students, but allows our employers and universities to get access to talent they would otherwise miss.
Wow, that's incredible.
Love that. Yeah. It feels really rounded as well. I think the community piece is so important because I suppose if they turn up to school and are like, oh, I want to go and do this thing, and their mates are all like, why would you want to do that? Suddenly, not only have you got imposter syndrome about it in the first place, but suddenly you're kind of being put off it because you're like, oh, hold on, this isn't cool. Whereas, if you can connect with someone like you that's, doesn't matter where they are in the world, but it's got the same ambition.
Yeah, you've got to make the platform experience addictive. And then this is where I think a lot of educational technology has gone wrong historically, where a lot of it is just like glamorized spreadsheets. You look at the software, like it looks like it's been designed on Microsoft Excel, and just a little bit of branding has been slapped on the top. And that is not an engaging experience for young people. And at the end of the day, a platform like Zero Gravity only works if you can get people engaged on it on a weekly basis for a long enough period of time for that to start to have an impact. So retention is the number one thing that we think about as a company. Now, how do you keep users hooked on the app? So in that way, it's similar to how a TikTok or a Netflix would look at users. Now, how do you keep people coming back every day? But the difference for us is we don't do it to advertise stuff to you or sell stuff to you. We do it because we know coming back on the app every day boosts your chances of getting in. But we use many of the same techniques that a lot of modern day consumer apps use of how do you almost make the experience addictive, but in a good way, so it doesn't feel like a kind of chore to use an app like Zero Gravity.
You provide so many opportunities for so many students. What's the most rewarding part of creating Zero Gravity?
I think it's the level of scale that's come out of it versus where we started. And that first cohort of students was around 150 students. And now there's 13,000 students every single year coming through this platform into university. And seeing that scale up has been amazing. It proves that this is a concept that has legs that people want, but there's still a long way to go. But behind every single one of those data points is a real living and breathing human being. And to sort of see just some of the stories and also see how individuals succeeding has been inspired the next generation in their school or in their local area is the thing that makes me think actually getting this right at scale can actually cause system-wide change. Because when I started Zero Gravity, Oxford and Cambridge used to be roughly 50-50 state and private school. And now, 7 years later, it's 70-30 state private school. So that's quite a big change in the demographic in quite a short period of time. That is going to influence who the next generation of business leaders are, academics, politicians. So just doing something in quite a narrow wedge of society at a big enough scale can actually create this system-wide change. And I want to make sure we can do that at every single leading university employer in the country, because for me, that is how you create the long-lasting change of breaking that link between background and opportunity, which everyone wants, everyone says they want, but is incredibly difficult to do. But I feel like we're making a dent in that.
Yeah, I feel like you are as well. So thinking more about your journey, so you've built a platform at one point that you've kind of coded yourself. You then, I'm guessing, went on a bit of a journey after that first cohort and seeing students actually getting to where you were hoping they would. I'm guessing, was there a point where you had investment, or how did you scale this business? And there must have been some hoops you had to jump through that were completely new to you as a young entrepreneur. I'd love to know a bit more about those.
So one of the kind of controversial decisions I took at the beginning of my journey is I was going to run this as a business rather than a nonprofit. So most kind of organizations in this space traditionally are nonprofits, because breaking that link between background and opportunity is seen as a kind of socially good thing to do, but not necessarily something with any kind of business justification or imperative behind it. And I just thought that was dead wrong, because I ultimately saw this issue as not just about doing the right thing, but as a problem of talent. And that every single company who is just fishing in a small pond of talent and not tapping into the talent across the entire UK is holding itself back in terms of what it can achieve. So I wanted to run Zero Gravity as a business from day one, but I knew, because we didn't want to charge the students, so we could only charge employees, universities, I knew it was going to take time to build a kind of traction and credibility to get there. So we raised investment to kind of get us through those first years when we weren't making any revenue. And indeed, the first time I ever raised investment was £100,000. And I couldn't believe someone was willing to invest that amount of money in my platform that wasn't generating any revenue. It was a very early stage product. But there's kind of people out there who, you know, if you are a founder who's got an idea and you've started to execute on it, you've built traction, built a community, you've got people loving your product, and you've got a plan of how you can monetize that over time, there are people out there who are willing to take a risk on people trying to make a difference. So that seemed crazy to me at the time, but that £100,000 investment back in 2019 was just the start of an investment journey where we've now raised £6.5 million since I started the organization. So that would have seemed unfathomable 7 years ago, but that is what is within reach if you can actually build something that has legs, that does make a difference, does create value for users, and ultimately starts to generate revenue as well.
Love it. And how much, so has a lot of that investment gone into creating the platform, or what else have you had to think about?
So because we're a digital platform, the cost of each additional student we bring on the platform is pretty low. So like, to use the kind of economics lingo, the marginal cost of each additional student is very small. And that's a massive advantage, because it means you can scale and scale and scale without having to massively increase the amount you're spending. But we do have a lot of fixed costs. So things like, you know, building the team that makes the entire company tick. We've got 30 employees, you know, spread across software engineering and product, growth team, and also a kind of partnerships team as well. So there's the team that you've got to fund. I mean, also things like, you know, building a brand, you know, marketing, you know, some of the sort of tech platform expenses. So all of these costs add up. But I think that the main thing to think about as a founder is, how do you do a lot with a little? Now, once you start raising significant amounts of investment, it can be very easy to get on the hype train of just thinking about how do you raise more and more and more and more and more. But as a kind of traditional Yorkshireman, I've always been a frugal person. I liked every penny to go as far as it can. So whenever I raise investment, I always do it on the basis of, this is the kind of thesis I'm trying to prove. This is how I'm going to spend the money. And I need to hit X, Y, and Z milestone to show this has worked before I can then go out to people and raise more. So that 6.5 million didn't appear in the bank account overnight. It's come through a process of kind of raising money, proving you can execute well, and raising even more then to keep growing.
Love that. And did you, obviously you mentioned that you came from a single parent family, your mum was a speech therapist, I think you said at the start. So this world would have been very different to her from raising investment, etc. So did you find a mentor? Was there someone that helped you work this out? Or was it finding YouTube videos on what to do next? Or how did you navigate that?
Yeah, it's obviously been quite a big social change. Because I mentioned, when I first started Zero Gravity, people thought I was a weirdo for kind of not taking up my graduate job and moving back home. And now when people kind of see the kind of numbers in the media, those £6.5 million of investment, all these big companies, all the kind of accolades, you know, Forbes 30 under 30, people like think I'm some kind of like multi-millionaire now, you know, jetting around on private jets and stuff like that. And the reality is that being a founder, even when you actually grow something, is still a really difficult life. You know, every day, it's not drinking champagne, it's not kind of, you know, lying around, it's, you know, working relentlessly, you know, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to actually prove that you can scale your idea into something that really, really works. So it's been not necessarily straightforward for people to get their head around, you know, the difference between the kind of glamour and the reality of growing a business. But I suppose what I have been able to do over time, which is nice, is actually build a kind of team around me. So when I started, for the first year, it was just me in my bedroom, completely by myself, bootstrapped. And even though that was great in terms of sort of getting going and sort of not requiring lots of cost, it's really tricky to go far when the only person you're relying on is yourself, and being able to bring people in who not only have different skills but also can challenge your ways of thinking is a way to sort of be able to go faster over time. So I think actually the people I've hired in many ways have reverse mentored me, because most of the people I hired were actually older than me, because I started this organization when I was 21. So I've learned so much from the people I've hired across, you know, product, engineering, growth and partnerships. And I know far more about those areas today than I ever dreamed I could know 7 years ago. So don't underestimate what somebody who you hire can teach you rather than what you can teach them.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Was that, do you think that was hard for them as well? Like, what was it like when you're first interviewing people that are older and more experienced than you and feeling like, well, I'm just 21 running this company? Was there some imposter syndrome there of, on your side, of how do I go about doing this and bringing in that experience?
There was definitely a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like, I didn't have any experience when it came to management or leadership. And to be honest, because I was a little bit of a nerd, I wasn't that interested in concepts like that either. Like, I always just thought about kind of strategy and product. I never thought about how do you get results through other people. So I had to sort of become a nerd about hiring top talent and building culture, which was completely new themes that I'd never thought about before. And it wasn't straightforward at the beginning, because age naturally does create imposter syndrome. And I didn't have any kind of like traditional authority or hierarchical authority I could fall back on, because I didn't have experience. And the first couple of people I was hiring was literally still in a tiny organization where people don't look over and think, oh, that's the big scary CEO, because the person's literally sat away just from there, you on the desk every single day. So I didn't have any of that traditional or hierarchical authority. So what you have to lean into as a young founder is charismatic authority, which is, if you don't have experience and you don't have the kind of prestige of hierarchy, you have to have that really clear mission and vision and evangelize about it every single day. And if you do that, people will buy into what you're doing and want to take a risk on you, and they want to take a bet on you and go on that journey with you. So that's what I leaned into. I didn't try and sort of boss people around or pretend to be somebody that I wasn't. I wasn't in the position to do that. What I did do is I just tried to absolutely build a culture that was, you know, fully in on Zero Gravity's mission and make every single person excited to come in every day, because they felt like they were part of building towards that.
The most authentic leadership there is. I love that. I can feel it as well coming out of you. Like it just oozes out of you naturally, which they would have been feeling. And also, like, that's why they would have taken the jobs. That's why they would have been on the mission with you, which is just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are Duolingo, Nike and McDonald's some of your favorite brands? For all the latest marketing and brand news, follow The Drum Mag on Instagram.
Outside of like professional work, what's one lesson that building Zero Gravity has taught you in everyday life that you use? Or what's like a takeaway you've got from your journey?
I think one almost depressing insight is you can't have it all. If you are building an early stage business, like I said, it's not glamour. It really is the hard work every single day. Even when you get through that first kind of building period, even when you hire a team and you've got revenue and you've raised investment, it only gets kind of harder as you go. So you've got to be realistic about your time and energy and where you're willing to invest that. And I decided, you know, very early doors that I was going to go all in on Zero Gravity. And that meant I was going to have to sacrifice various things from my life. So now in the, especially the first, you know, 5 years, I didn't get to spend as much time with my friends as I would have wanted to. I didn't get to spend as much time with my family as I would have wanted to. Now, COVID was an incredibly lonely experience because, you know, I was trapped inside by myself of the flat I was living in. And literally for that sort of 6-9 month period, you know, the only people I saw every day was my kind of people I was working with at Zero Gravity. So you've got to be prepared to make sacrifices. And that doesn't mean you can't have anything else going on in your life, but you have to pick maybe like the one other big thing that you're going to put time into, whether it's your relationship with a partner, whether it's no friends, or whether you've got like a hobby that consumes time. Be realistic and go all in on two things, but don't pretend that you every single part of your life can be kind of fully developed and rosy, because ultimately building a business is a sacrifice. So you better build a business that is worth the sacrifice if you are going to go all in. Now, don't build some incredibly boring accounting software if you're someone who's not interested and passionate about accounting. If you're going to go all in, it better be something that's going to be worth it, because building a business is a sacrifice more than anything else.
Yeah, that's great advice.
So true. Have you thought about taking the platform to different countries? Like, straight away in my head, the States comes to mind. Of actually, there's a lot of prestigious universities there, and a huge amount of ground across the country where people no doubt are not getting the opportunity or seeing the opportunity.
In the long term, 100%, like, this problem of that link between background and opportunity is a problem in every single developed and developing economy across the world. And even though Americans kind of instinctively get this because they have the whole concept of the American dream, which is sort of specifically about this problem, actually, when you look at the data, America does worse even than the UK when it comes to that link between background and an opportunity. So we've already done a small pilot in the States. We got a small grant from Harvard University to prove that we could get low-income students in the UK into American colleges. And what's exciting about that is, even though the American college system can be very expensive, the amount of scholarships they've got for people from low-income backgrounds absolutely dwarfs what's available in the UK. There are a lot of these Ivy League universities, if you come from a household where your household income is less than 150 grand a year, you can get a full ride scholarship, all your tuition paid for, all your accommodation. So that covers, in UK terms, the vast majority of the households in the UK. So if you can get into one of these Ivy League colleges, it can actually be very transformational and actually quite low cost. So I think there's a huge opportunity for us there long term. But as I mentioned at the beginning, I don't believe in overnight successes. No. I don't want to run before we can walk. So we're only going to expand full throttle into the US once we've made our business high scale and sustainable in the UK first. And what that looks like is, there's roughly 60,000 students every year in the UK who come from low income backgrounds, but have got that proven academic talent at school, which means they should be going to one of these top universities and careers. At the moment, we're supporting around 13,000, that 60,000, but we want to get to that full audience. As soon as we've got close to that, that's when we'll look at going stateside. And I might have to potentially move out to one of those big, scary American cities.
What a shame that would be. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it does make sense. And are there competitors that you're fighting with what you're trying to do? Obviously, it sounds weird saying fighting, because you're all doing a good thing if that's the case. But yeah, what's the competition like here in the UK?
So we don't have any like-for-like competitor, because I mentioned historically people have seen this as a charitable issue rather than a business issue. But we've got two kind of adjacent competitors. One is your traditional legacy charities and what I call kind of CSR initiatives. So those would be charities who kind of do, you know, summer schools or maybe talks in classrooms, or even the in-house programs of corporates, universities, when they try and do this themselves. So those are organizations who are trying to tackle the same social mission as we are, and they're competitors, maybe not in terms of business, but competitors in terms of brand and engaging students in something that is useful and worthwhile. I mean, the more commercial competitors we have are kind of your traditional recruitment platforms. So you kind of jobs boards, recruitment companies who try and get talent into universities and careers. And obviously those companies, they don't usually care at all about students' backgrounds. They just want to get bums on seats and recruitment results. But what they do care about is partnering with companies and universities. So those are more kind of business competitors for us. So in any market, no matter what you do, no matter how niche, there'll always be someone else that's trying to fight with you, whether it's for brand awareness, user love, or business. And in many ways, you should embrace that, because that kind of competitive spirit is what drives this modern economy that we operate in. So I relentlessly look at what all of our competitors are doing, because I want to understand, and what do they know that we don't, and how can we use that to make our products and business as fantastic as possible for our members?
Definitely. And it's always a good sign that there's competitors, because it means you're obviously knocking on a door of something that makes sense. If you're there completely on your own, it's sometimes so. That's really good to hear. If you look back to, let's go all the way back to school age, did you see yourself as being a founder of a company? Is that something that was on your radar? Or was it more the idea came and then you were like, I could do this?
Not in any serious sense. Like, I did sort of have these delusions of grandeur when I was a sort of teenager, and where I used to be obsessed with technology, and I used to listen to podcasts back in the day where you didn't even have kind of Spotify or the Apple Podcasts app. You just used to have to download them on RSS feeds, which you probably have got absolutely no idea about, but literally you have to do this really nerdy thing to be able to download the podcast. But I was obsessed about all this innovation that was going on the other side of the world from Morley. And I just wanted to have a piece of that and sort of be part of it and show that I could build products that would actually change people's lives. So I kind of had a kind of delusion in that sense, but I never seriously thought this was a kind of sustainable, realistic career for someone like me. And it was only when graduating from university that I kind of had the thought of actually, even though I'm 21 years old, this is probably the best time in my life to give this a go, because even though I've got no resources, no experience, no track record, what I don't have at this point is obligations. No, I didn't have no children, and no, didn't have any other kind of financial obligations, no mortgage, no sort of credit card debts. So I thought I'm going to go all in at this point, because if I wait 10, 20 years, it's going to be far, far more difficult to sort of jump into this crazy world that is startups. And that's why I decided to give it a go. But more out of delusion than anything else, to be honest.
I think most people, if you ask most founders, would you start again? They're like, oh no, like I'm glad I was as naive as I was when I mean, it's definitely my story is very glad I was as naive as I was, because when you know too much, it is much scarier. And as you say, when you've got more responsibility and you've got bills to pay and mouths to feed, it's suddenly a lot harder to take that risky step, because it is a risk.
And that's, I think, one of the most difficult parts about being a founder and a CEO, which is in many ways the mental states that you have to embody every day are riddled with contradictions. So you have to be the kind of delusional, naive person who champions this mission and kind of instills in people that they can do something that statistically seems impossible. But on the flip side, you also have to be rational and make kind of cold, calculated decisions every day about the steps to take to get there. And like with leadership, for instance, you have to be that person with the kind of EQ, understanding what makes people tick, how do they operate, how do you get the best out of them, but also the person who can kind of drive high expectations, can in many ways be unreasonable and not kind of buy into people's kind of fixed mindset, but get them to kind of see that a different way of doing things or a different level to get to is possible. So you're constantly faced with all of these kind of contradictory aspects that you have to inhabit at the same time. And that's why I think the kind of mindset of being a founder in many ways is the trickiest thing to get right. You have to be a little bit crazy, to be honest, which is why when you do see a lot of these people, especially glamorized in the media and in these kind of hit pieces, they do seem like crazy characters, because often that is what you have to be to get to that point, unfortunately.
Yeah. You just said a bunch of skills that people should have. What do you think is one key skill that makes it, that helps you become where you've got today?
I think perseverance is the key thing. So no matter how incredible your idea is, no matter how clever your strategy, no matter how great your team, nothing happens overnight. So you have to persevere even through that really tricky trough period at the beginning where you don't see your results. Like in some ways, it's similar to kind of like learning a sport or exercising, where you have to sort of, you know, keep going, sort of build that habit of doing something every day, whether it's playing football or going to the gym, whatever it is. And the trickiest part is that first month, because you're putting in all this hard work, but perceptibly you can't see the results. Now you're still rubbish at football, or if you're going to the gym, you can't see the changes yet in what you see in the mirror. So you have to be someone who's able to persevere despite the results not being perceptible for the first period. And if you do that long enough, you will eventually get to that flywheel where suddenly things seem like they're all happening overnight and everything's coming together. And then people will talk about that as, I got lucky, or no, things just happened to work out. But in reality, it happens because of that period beforehand where you just pushed and pushed and pushed despite the fact the results didn't come. So you have to have a certain sort of mindset to be able to persevere. And some people have that naturally. Some people build that like a muscle over time. And some people get it because they have some kind of drive that makes not doing it almost worse than keeping going. And for me, to be honest, I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder because I'd faced this problem firsthand myself. I thought, if I don't make this work, I'm letting down future generations like me. So I had that sort of almost negative driving desire, which is I'm going to keep doing this because I don't want to let down these people like me. And that is a good thing in many ways. If you have that weird thing that animates you, and it can be a weird thing. It could be that to throw out a weird example, a lot of businesses start out of breakups where a founder has broken up with a partner and they're in a really tricky mental space and they're like, I'm going to do this because this is going to get me out of this situation. Uh-huh. It can be something completely random like that. But if you use that to build that perseverance to get you through that trough period, that is a thing that really, really matters.
Yeah. Love that. You mentioned the spark for this initially was that radio interview, thinking about going to Oxford. Have you still got that?
Yes, I actually reconnected with the radio presenter who did that interview around 2 years ago. And then he interviewed me again on Radio Leeds and they played a clip from the original interview.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
It was a real nice sort of full circle moment.
Oh, if you've got it, we might have to clip that in. We can play it in here for the audience. So you spend your life then seeing young people and seeing the journey they go on. What's your, like, what's your lasting piece of advice that you'd like to come out of this episode for our audience listening that are could be anywhere in their journey? They could be still at school, sixth form. They could be just starting university. They could be onto their first job. But what's the thing that will get them going from this to say they can make anything possible?
I think, like, if not you, then who? At the end of the day, like, a lot of people struggle to see themselves at a particular university or in a particular career because they haven't seen anyone else like them do it before. But in order to achieve things in life, you have to be that person who defies the odds and goes where other people never have gone before. And countless people have done that before you. You know, most of the kind of biggest celebrities, personalities that you know about today, at one point were a kind of anxious 16-year-old in a similar position to yourself. So it is possible to defy the odds, but it is hard work. And being willing to actually put in the effort to set a goal and persevere for a long period of time is the most simplest route to achieving anything that you want to do in life. And very few things are so difficult and intractable that you can't get there through hard work and perseverance. Now, if you're naturally intelligent and naturally smart, of course, school comes a little bit easier to you than most people. But schoolwork isn't so hard that even somebody who's had a tricky start through hard work and perseverance can't turn things around and get a solid set of grades to unlock their future. So I know in many ways that's quite mundane advice. Maybe that's just a slightly nicer way of putting it than people's teachers say it. But honestly, hard work, perseverance does pay off. Mm-hmm. And the best time to start is now.
That's great. Yeah. I love that. This has been incredible.
It really has.
You are really inspiring and you're helping so many young people. When I found you online, I was like, we need to have this conversation. We need to hear more. Uh-huh. So I'm so glad that you came to see us today and have shared your story with us, because it's fantastic. And I think
amazing.
It will inspire so many people. So thank you so much, Jo. You've been fantastic. Yes. Nina, you've been wonderful.
Thank you.
And you can catch us on a future episode of Behind the Future. That concludes another brilliant episode of Behind the Future. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen back to other episodes on YouTube or your podcast platform of choice. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, as that will help us to grow this podcast, ensuring we can get the best guests on here for you to learn from. You can also follow us on socials, linked in the show notes for exclusive content. See you on the next episode.